This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the worlds of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Well, lots of virus headlines to get to right now, Kriti Gupta. We do tend to track what's happening globally and, of course, what's happening here in the United States as well. Cases around the world have topped 214.9 million. Deaths worldwide passing 4.47 million. More than 5.1 billion doses of the vaccine have been administered. Do keep in mind that many of those vaccines do require two shots, so a portion of that includes people who are not yet fully vaccinated. Also, we're seeing a judge in Florida blocking from enforcing Governor Ron DeSantis' ban on mask mandates in schools. That clears the way for educators to require face coverings in classrooms without the threat of retaliation by the state. Let's get into it, as we do each and every Friday, with Dr. Ian Lustbader, clinical professor of medicine at NYU Langone's Medical Center, joining us on the phone, as he does each and every week, from New York. Dr. Lustbader, how are you on this Friday afternoon?
Great, Tim and Kriti. Hope all is well, and happy Friday.
Yeah, we are having a good Friday. A lot of interesting stories about the virus that we want to get to. We are learning that COVID, people who have been infected by COVID in the past, Dr. Lustbader, actually are protected from the Delta variant, perhaps better than the Pfizer vaccine. What do you make of that news?
So that's a very interesting recent revelation based on an article that really has data primarily coming out of Israel. And this supports really what we've known in the past, and actually was touched on by a debate between Rand Paul and Dr. Fauci a few months ago about whether vaccinated or whether people who've had COVID needed to be vaccinated. In other words, the benefit of natural immunity. So in many diseases, for example, mumps, measles, rubella, kids who get those have lifetime immunity, usually. Kids who do not get them and get the vaccine often have immunity that drops off, and you need to give them boosters. It now appears that people in Israel who had COVID-19 really are protected for a fairly long period of time, not really indefinitely, and vaccines certainly boost their immunity. But when you compare the people who had COVID-19 to people who just had the Pfizer vaccine, the people who had the vaccine alone were really 6 to 7 times more likely to get a Delta infection or symptomatic infection than the people who previously had the COVID-19 infection. In other words, the virus itself really does provide robust and long-lasting immunity. We also do know those patients, when they are given a booster shot, have even higher levels. The problem, of course, is that it's hard to check that for the people who've had COVID-19 because their antibodies drop, their IgGs drop over time, and it would appear they're not protected. But this really does support, you know, the so-called memory cells that do provide ongoing protection. So I think it's very interesting. It's reassuring to the people who've had COVID-19. Who have yet to get a vaccine, probably would be smart to get a vaccine, but certainly this is reassuring to those who had COVID-19, and certainly is still a message to people who are unprotected that if unless you're going to get COVID-19, it probably would be smart to get a vaccine.
So, Professor, how does this really impact travel, for example? Because I feel like, at least in my peer group, the minute everyone got their vaccinations, they said, you know what, we're going to Europe, we're going to South America, we're taking all these trips we haven't been able to for a year and counting. How does this really change the game, especially in light of those new variants, whether it's the Delta variant or the Lambda variant?
So certainly for the people who've had COVID-19, they have a much lower risk of getting Delta and should feel pretty reassured, even if they had that within, say, the last 6 to 9 months. For the people who are vaccinated, yes, if you've had that within, say, 6 to 8 months, you're probably fairly well protected. Unfortunately, what we're seeing is more Delta breakthroughs in the vaccinated group, and certainly even in the unvaccinated group. So really what I would say is be smart. If you've had COVID or if you've had the vaccines, it's helpful. You're certainly much less likely to get a serious infection, but don't be reckless. Probably smart to wear masks. Certainly a shorter plane flight is probably better than a longer plane flight. Avoid crowded areas. You have some protection, but we are seeing breakthrough infections. And be careful.
Would you avoid international travel to certain places that aren't well vaccinated or well covered by the vaccine?
I think that that would be smart. You know, why put yourself at risk? There are many countries that require antibody titers, or when you arrive there, not only do you have to show a COVID vaccination card, but they actually draw levels, antibody levels, to really prove that you have antibodies, which in the case of if you've had COVID-19, you're going to be in trouble, because even though you may be protected, your serum antibodies or spike antibodies or even IgG is very low. So I would avoid countries that have a high level of Delta and COVID, because there can be breakthrough infections. Granted, they're not terrible, but we still are seeing some percent getting hospitalized. So I would still be careful over the next few months until the waves of COVID really go through. And that may take several more months, certainly in the U.S. and around the world.
Yeah, it's certainly, I think, a lot of people didn't think that we'd be back in the office wearing masks, or we'd be having to wear masks inside again because of a variant that the vaccine is allowing to break through in some instances. Let's get right back to Dr. Ian Lustbader, clinical professor of medicine at NYU Langone's Medical Center, joining us once again on the phone from New York City. Dr. Lustbader, I wanted to get your thoughts on a new vaccine from China that's showing 82% effectiveness against serious COVID. It's from China's Chongqing Zhifei Biological Products Company, and it showed as 92.93% effective against the Alpha variant and almost 78% against the more infectious Delta version. That's according to a filing that the company made earlier today. It did not say if those two figures were just for serious illness or all symptomatic infections, including mild cases. How important is this of a development, not necessarily for China, but to get the world vaccinated?
You're exactly right, Tim. You know, we're talking billions of people. It's going to take quite a while, just even mechanically, no less with availability of vaccine, to really vaccinate that many people. And unfortunately, as we're seeing, either people will get the disease or they will get the vaccine. There's really no middle ground for people who think they can escape it. Masks and other social distancing and all of that may be helpful. But really, with a massive pandemic like this, it's going to be very unlikely not to at least be exposed. You know, I think any new vaccine that's effective is welcome. It's really no surprise that it's 92% against the Alpha variant, which it was probably developed against. 78% against Delta is certainly reasonable. It's better than nothing. For sure, and it's certainly better than the flu shots. So I think this is a welcome addition. It's similar to the technology for Novavax. The mRNA vaccines are an amazing breakthrough, very effective, and they will be able to be tweaked better, I think, to new variants that come along and probably be effective for many other kinds of diseases, cancer and a variety of other approaches. But this more traditional vaccine approach certainly is helpful. It is a little late in the game, but it's certainly not too late, because we really have billions to vaccinate. So I think it's a welcome addition, and hopefully we'll have a good safety profile in addition to a reasonable efficacy profile.
Well, doctor, let's talk about the treatment plans here, because we talked about travel in the previous segment. I really want to ask you about simply the process that it takes, the kind of sweet spot in testing. If someone were to test positive, how quickly should treatment be given to them? Can you give us your take on that?
So that's also really a great question. You know, we focus so much on diagnosis with swabs and PCRs, and we've focused a lot on making a diagnosis of prevention with masks. We've really dropped the ball, I think, on treatment. And a variety of other physicians have spoken out in this, professors from Texas A&M, frontline physicians in critical care, and have really said that we've needed protocols and studies to do better than just what we have available now, which is monoclonal antibodies. There are many other drugs that may be effective off the shelf. A variety of meta-analyses, the Wall Street Journal has written about ivermectin and other drugs, which may very well be useful. And
might not be useful, too.
Or might not be useful, right.
We should
certainly
know.
There are some,
and we see a lot of people, it's concerning that we see a lot of people just going right to it instead of getting vaccinated.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. This is no substitute. So for obviously, the best thing is to prevent a disease. That's really what you want to do, if at all possible. And the vaccines are highly effective at doing that. For people, and even in breakthrough, where people have been vaccinated and they've gotten symptomatic COVID-19, we really need to come up with some approaches. Not everyone is even aware of monoclonal antibodies, and they're really widely available throughout the United States. So many people feel that we should have had a panel of real clinicians who treat patients advising the White House that maybe it's not up to the president or the head of the CDC. Maybe we need a panel of really experts who look at studies, generate studies, have a discussion, and come up with treatment protocols that are well established, as well as prevention and diagnosis. So, you know, it's important to have that. Obviously, when people are hospitalized, we have approaches with blood thinners and steroids and so forth. But for those patients who are outpatient, who are somewhat
right.
sick, we use the monoclonal antibodies,
right.
and maybe we should be using other things too.
Dr. Ian Lusbader, we're going to have to leave it there. We enjoy it each and every week when you join us on Bloomberg Business Week Radio. Dr. Lusbader is clinical professor of medicine at NYU Langone's Medical Center, joining us on the phone from New York City.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Shares of Dell Technologies right now down about 4% this afternoon. This after the company reported earnings after the bell yesterday. Sales and profit topped projections, that on persistent demand for PCs. Quarterly adjusted EBITDA, though, missed estimates slightly as revenue from its infrastructure solutions group came up short. Matt Baker is chief strategy officer at Dell. He joins us on the phone now from Austin, Texas. Matt, it's really great to have you on the show. Thanks for joining us. How are you this afternoon?
I'm great, and it's great to be here.
Hey, let's dive into earnings. So, shares down 4%, 3.93% right now as we speak. This on a day when we're seeing broad-based gains across the equity markets. What are investors missing from what otherwise was a really solid quarter?
Well, I think it was a really solid quarter. We had record revenues, record op inc. We're really pleased with the growth in an environment where we're seeing good demand. So, you know, stocks fluctuate, but we're really happy with the quarter and pleased with the performance of the team.
Well, let's talk about the chip shortage in particular, because this is something that's not just going to be affecting your company, but affecting the world broadly, regardless of what sector or what tech subsector you're in. Dell's predicting a better third quarter than normal. How are you going to keep up when you have these chip shortages that you have to deal with?
Well, I think, you know, we've got the elite athletes of the supply chain game, and I think that's what you saw in our results. We have better supply. We're better able to supply our customers, and therefore we have these record shipments. We shipped a record 14.8 million PCs, a record 7.8 million displays. So while there are chip shortages out there, our supply chain team is doing a fabulous job, and as Patrick Moorhead said in a tweet yesterday, they deserve a gold medal. And so we're pleased with our performance, and we are working through the supply chain challenges. But to be honest with you, we have a team that's been dealing with supply chain disruptions, be it tariffs, be it part shortages. So we just feel really pleased with where we are in terms of our ability to execute.
I'm wondering particularly about concerns that some investors and analysts have been expressing, that we're seeing the peak for laptops right now, and the current elevated demand that we have seen isn't necessarily sustainable. Are they right to have that concern?
I don't think so. And I think what, if anything, the last few years have shown is how central technology is to doing business and going to school and, you know, just a part of our lives. And we used to think that, you know, one laptop or one PC per household was sufficient. That's no longer the case. It's one or multi per person. And it's how we drive productivity across all facets of society. So we believe there is a actually change, significant change in sort of what customers are looking for, what they expect, and what they need to be productive in their lives. It's a work from anywhere, school from anywhere, shop from anywhere world, and that requires more PCs, laptops, desktops, etc. And last, you know, the PC has proven to be the central productivity device, and therefore central to everybody's daily lives. So we do think there's something different.
Yeah, Matt, that's really interesting to hear, given that there are so many devices out there that really want to be that one device to rule them all, whether it is a larger than normal smartphone or a tablet that does come with a keyboard. Help us from a strategy perspective, give us the vision of what that multi-device person looks like.
Well, I think it looks like most of us today, which is, you know, the tablet market in its sort of early infancy form factor has grown and then tapered off. Form factors like notebooks and desktops have shrunk, changed, and are more portable than ever, but of course, notebooks themselves. So it's, you know, a phone plus a notebook, and that seems to be what we're sort of converging on as what people use to communicate. And then productivity, I think we've all experienced what a legacy tablet is like. It's just insufficient. And so we believe we've developed the form factors with our notebooks to sort of put the PC far ahead of the tablet in terms of requirements for our customers.
I'd like to follow up on one of those questions on the demand piece of the equation, because we've seen the pandemic return to work dynamic get halted, get started. You've seen it really kind of fold into the demand for computers. Where are we in that cycle? And how do you in particular, how does Dell in particular really price in that future demand when that return to work plan is still kind of hanging up in the air?
Well, I think that the reality is that the return to work doesn't necessarily change the demand environment based on how we've come to work throughout the pandemic. So while we may return to the office at some point in the future, significant portions, I think, of the workforce are going to find themselves in a hybrid work model. And those needs are still there. They don't go away, right? So people will continue to need PCs. They'll continue to stay on top of the refresh cycle. And also, we found how essential technology is to learning for our children. And there's still many, you know, school-age children out there that need PCs to thrive in a school setting. So we see a robust demand environment going forward, and that the return to work doesn't necessarily change much. We have established a new way of working and a new way of living, and I don't believe that changes as the pandemic wanes.
Hey, Matt, I want to hit on subscription-based services and the way that the company is trying to transform into one that sells more of these subscription-based services rather than relying on revenue from one-time purchases of hardware. From a strategy perspective, what specifically are you doing to push more and more customers into ones that pay subscriptions monthly or yearly?
Yeah, well, what we want to do is we want to meet our customers where they want to be, and many of them are asking for more of these subscription-oriented services. And so over the past year and a half, we've launched a number of offerings in our line called Apex. Apex is a collection of subscription services from cloud, public cloud, private cloud solutions, of course, storage solutions, and ultimately all of our portfolio can be available through a subscription service, and we have a number of different solutions that are more of a custom solution, if you will, to packaged subscription-based services within the Apex envelope.
Matt, I want to ask you one last question here on the supply chain, because you talked about having a very strong supply chain, but how did geopolitics change the game on that? Is that something that's even on your radar?
Well, I think that, you know, that I mentioned sort of the supply chain challenges that preceded the pandemic and the chip supply shortage around tariffs and geopolitical shocks, if you will. And what I would say is what that taught us a few years ago was the importance of supply chain diversity. And of course, as the elite athletes of supply chain games, we have diversified our supply chain, and that has provided a lot more resilience. Of course, there's other news out there in terms of domestic chip production.
Right.
Of course, that's what the, you know, the chip producers are working through now.
Yeah, that is the story when it comes to IT right now. Matt Baker, Chief Strategy Officer at Dell, joining us from Austin, Texas. Matt, thank you so much for taking the time.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, we continue to monitor the ongoing situation in Afghanistan. President Biden late yesterday reiterated his goal and his withdrawal date of August 31st, saying the United States is sticking to that. The president also saying yesterday in an address to the nation that the United States will hunt down and hold those accountable responsible for yesterday's attack. Joining us now is Dr. Sonia Stribling, retired U.S. Army major and former battle captain and redeployment officer, joining us on the phone from Los Angeles. Dr. Stribling, it is really great to have you on the program. We certainly appreciate you taking the time. I just want to reflect on what's been happening in Afghanistan, not just over the last 20 years, of course, but really throughout the month of August, as we have seen so much chaos in an attempt for the United States to get out of there by this August 31st deadline. Was it the right move for President Biden to withdraw troops by 9/11?
First, Tim, thank you so much for having me and really speak on this topic at hand. You know, I'm not not a politician or anything like that, but what I will say, being the commander-in-chief and the president of the United States, it is a hard decision to make. Of course, he has his staff members and all of that advising him, but you know, I won't sit back and like so many other people out there to make a judgment of whether we should or we shouldn't. There was a call that is made. Now we, as the United States and our troops and all of that, have to follow through with the orders that have been provided to them. And I almost said us, but just really thinking through the things that have to take place before they redeploy and even when they get back homeland for sure.
Let's talk about for a second the evacuation process, because that's going to be a really crucial part of this conversation. Can you first talk to us and talk to our listeners about how that really works? How does the U.S. military decide who does get to leave Afghanistan and who doesn't?
Well, it's more so is not just who gets to leave and who doesn't, but who gets to leave first as far as the manifest and what are the personnel, you know, and the job or the responsibility that I had when I was still active duty as a battle captain. It was a responsibility of looking at all boots on ground. And boots on ground are where are the troops at exactly, what organization or unit are they a part of, and who needs to move out first. And what we're looking at right now, because of the mandate of the time frame that they have to redeploy back home, is who gets to leave first, and more so of the accountability, where is everyone? The concern that I had then and the more of a concern that I have now is the accountability of the civilian personnel. Yes, our troops are even the more important, but the accountability overall. And what I've seen then and even I hear about it even now is where the civilian population and where do they lie? They come into the country, and you all heard the news just as much as I did of them showing up, G7 showing up unexpected, unannounced, and unapproved, and just showing up in the country. And that was a concern then and even more so now. The second part of that is with the troops of who hits the ground first or the boots on ground. And as they redeploy, who leaves first? And more than likely for me, when I was in Iraq, I was the first one, or my team and I were the first ones to leave, so we can get the accountability when we left. And then as they all redeployed back to the United States.
Dr. Stribling, do you think that the United States, do you anticipate the United States will be able to safely evacuate every American who is there now who wants to leave by August 31st?
Yeah. Tim, that's a great question, and I've been asked that question several times. And I would say what the United States military has been very much trained to do and do very well is to be able to pivot on a dime. We are always at the ready, and that's what we've been trained to do. And the responsibility of for us to get out sooner than later is something that, again, we do very well. We're always on the ready, and I'm highly confident that we will get out if that is the case continuing forward. Of course, we only have a few more days, per se, left, but it can be done. And as you've seen so far, we've redeployed troops already and civilians. It can be done when it's mandatory and it's necessary.
So, Doctor, you mentioned that we do, of course, have only a few more days. I really want to talk to you about what these next couple of days really look like as you start to see really the last of the evacuations really take place. And, of course, the perimeter that the U.S. military has built at Kabul Airport, or at the airport in Kabul, I should say, as that turns to close and we really want to get those troops out, those very last troops that remain on the ground as well. What's your take on that?
You know, when I heard the news, of course, like you all did just the other day, and my condolences go out to the family members of those loved ones that were lost yesterday. But one of the biggest things and the concern that we have now is, of course, as you said, the perimeter and the Afghans allowing us out of that location. The concern is now, and I share very briefly, you call it a blackout. There's a blackout that I'm sure that took place yesterday with the bombing and all of that. And that blackout, typically what happens is when that something of that situation happens, blackout, no communication with the outside forces, I mean outside the U.S., because of the concern that someone may leak the names of the deceased. And we want to make sure that the family members are notified first before the rest of the world finds out. And that was one of the responsibilities I had as well. And it wasn't one that, you know, I really think about even more so, and my heart goes out to them. So when those blackouts, they're absolutely necessary. And that's the first part. And then the second part is just getting everyone home safely. And there are going to be some casualties, as we already see, and it's unfortunate. But we're dealing with times now that we don't have complete control, I would say, over every situation that is taking place. But again, I am very confident that the president and his staff members and those that are supporting him are doing their very best of what they can do at this time based on the situations that we're forced with.
Well, the president has made the 31st of this month the deadline, and he is sticking to that deadline for getting Americans and getting the United States out of Afghanistan after a war that has been nearly 20 years. Dr. Sonia Stribling, retired U.S. Major, Army Major, and former battle captain and redeployment officer, joining us on the phone from Los Angeles. Thank you so much for taking the time.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive home.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Just drive, baby.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
It certainly is the Drive to the Close. We are just over 10 minutes away from the close of trading on this Friday, August 27th. And look at that. If the S&P 500 closes at a record today, it'll be the 52nd record for the S&P 500 so far this year. Here to help us drive to the close on Bloomberg Business Week this afternoon is Mark Travis, President and CEO of Intrepid Capital, joining us on the phone from Jacksonville, Florida. Mark, we got to start with Jackson Hole, or the virtual Jackson Hole Symposium, as it ended up being. Equity markets really liking what they heard from Jay Powell.
The morphine drip of QE continues.
The morphine drip of QE continues. There it is.
What's not to like? I feel no pain. I guess the question is, what's priced in properly? The 10-year Treasury, gold, or is inflation really going to come down?
Is inflation going to come down? I mean, Fed Chair Powell and other members of the Fed continue to beat the transitory drum.
Well, I think if we go back over the history of the Federal Reserve, they've certainly made policy errors in the past, and I don't see there's any reason they can't make them in the future.
So, Mark, what's it going to take for the morphine drip to run out? What's it going to take for this bull market to drop, correct, pull back,
well,
whatever you want to call it?
I mean, look, we've all, I think, enjoyed it, and I certainly have. But if, you know, off my Bloomberg this afternoon, if I'm going to quote you some trailing numbers on the S&P, and they're really just, I don't see how they could get much better. They probably will, but it's hard to, you know, the S&P's up over 20% year to date, trailing 1 year's over 30% return, 3 years 1792, and the 5 years 1775. There are not that many periods in my 37-year history in the capital markets where you've seen that high of run rate. So I don't know. I mean, I would prepare for some adjustment at some point. When that occurs, I don't know. I think as long as you've got rates where they are and people can, you know, arbitrage cheap financing with almost anything that looks better, it will continue.
How are you preparing for that time? Like, what are you specifically doing for clients right now?
Well, in the private client world, we tend to think of buckets of liquidity, longevity, and legacy, and make sure they've got plenty of liquidity and enough fixed income for longevity. The legacy is more of a equity asset that, you know, maybe their children will benefit from. But as far as the portfolio management, I think where we've seen good results is in short duration kind of crossover credits where we can pick up a spread. There's a lot of unrated credits that are unrated for simply for the reason they're small issues and they don't want to pay the credit rating agencies to rate them. But in our fixed income fund, ticker ICMUX, we've done well. You can pull it and look at it. But that's been a place that we think has good risk-adjusted returns because we're at the top of the capital market. A lot of times we're the only credit involved in the cap structure. And as far as equity, I think we've spent a lot of time over the last few years looking at securities we valued even 20 years ago and how well they've done. And, you know, I think that, and you guys have probably seen this, if you look at, you'll hear people say, well, if you don't Amazon since its IPO, you'd have made X bajillion percent. But along the way, there's 80 or 90% drawdowns peak to valley. So I think, you know, in a land where we're now forcing money into ETFs that largely hug the index, I think there's a lot of opportunity away from it if you're willing to be patient and understand the business and the cash flows and the valuation.
Mark, let's talk hedges here. How are you hedging for this eventual downtrend that we may eventually see? Is it gold? Is it options? Is it treasuries? The dollar? Big tech? What do you like best?
Well, I think it's interesting to me, and I mentioned gold. It's certainly rallied today, but I believe it's still off 4 or 5% year to date. I don't have the data in front of me, but if we were to price gold from, say, January 1 of 2000 to now in the S&P, my bet is they're probably very similar type return. It's certainly a non-correlated asset, but there's a variety of ways. I think traditionally inside Intrepid Capital, that's been our willingness to hold cash until we found a security that we liked the valuation, whether that's equity or debt. And so that's somewhat of a buffer. The other one is in the fixed income that I mentioned. You always kind of have maturities rolling toward you. When you've got as short a duration portfolio as we do, it's almost like a kind of an escalator coming toward you with maturity. So that gives you a buffer both to readjust if rates, credit spreads are to widen, or if equity prices are drop, you've got some fresh powder, so to speak.
Hey, Mark, I want to hear what your thoughts on cannabis and specifically Trulieve. The company's executives have been on our show in the past. Why are you bullish on the company?
I think, to me, it's just amazing what a disparity there is right now in the capital markets in cannabis. Trulieve being one shining example, and that one is maybe has a little different issues than others. But I think in terms of the growth rate, the margins, and the disparity right now is, and as we've learned at Intrepid, anything that's cannabis touching is kind of verboten in a lot of the capital markets, whether that's a custodial bank, a broker-dealer, whatever it may be. And so you have a very low institutional sponsorship, all coupled with literally year-over-year growth rates and revenue of probably 75 to 80%, with margins somewhere in the 40 to 50% range, depending on the business. Keep in mind that the Safe Banking Act would allow them, the technicality is 280E, which is basically these businesses, even generating those margins, are not allowed to deduct what you and I might consider normal business expenses.
Right.
So
because there are federal issues with this.
Correct. And so you've had the House of Representatives, Congress, passed the Safe Banking Act in 19, but right now Schumer is trying to get at some point pass the Safe Banking Act, which would allow these companies access to the U.S. capital markets as well as the U.S. banking system. The challenge is, as some of us know, is you you've got a very narrow majority, including Kamala Harris, to break a tie, and you really need to bring along 10 Republican senators to get that bill to passage. Now, when and where that occurs, I don't know. So I think there's a lot of speculation around how far out in the future that is. I think you could make a case of truly, for example, in our community here, there's a facility along the beach that's probably 1,500 square feet doing $12 to $15 million in revenue. Well, those things literally are cash cows.
Right.
Because so just from a community safety standpoint, I think, you know, we could argue, Republican or Democrat, that we need to make those places less of a
target. And certainly a lot of that has to do with what happens in Washington, D.C. Mark Travis, we unfortunately have to leave it there, but we are looking forward to getting you back on the show. Mark is president and CEO of Intrepid Capital, joining us on the phone from Jacksonville, Florida.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.